One night in March 1995, a US teenager walked a short distance home from her boyfriend's house. It was a journey that she'd never complete. Her body was found the next day, a short distance from her home. Over a quarter of a century later, her brutal murder remains unsolved. This is the story of a horrific crime that not only took a young girl's life full of promise, but also destroyed a family. This is the murder of Deanna Kremen.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen.
Today's case is a frustrating one. I'm always frustrated when I do an unsolved case. I like closure and I like justice, but I also think it's really important to cover cases that aren't solved in the hope that someone can just add some information to a case that to some degree is cold and that hopefully can warm that case again. So I think it is important to cover this case, although as ever, the fact that there is a young woman whose life was stolen and we don't know who killed her and the killer is still at large is not something that sits well with any of us. So let's talk about Deanna Kremen. Well, she was really a special human being. So she was born on the 26th of March, 1978. And she lived with a really close-knit family. She lived in Winter Hill, Somerville, Massachusetts. She had a mother, Kathy. She had a stepfather, Michael. She had a big sister, Christine, and little brothers, Mark and Albert. She was a brilliant big sister, genuinely. She had a real connection with children, full stop. It was something that was really, really important to her. So she was very much involved with her younger siblings. She looked out for them a great deal. And her youngest brother was actually 11 years her junior. So she really could play very big sister to that little boy. And again, I think that helped to shape the connection that she had with children and the desire that she had in the future to think about a career with kids. She was also very close, particularly close to her older sister, Christine. There was actually just 17 months between them. Although with respect, I have children who only have a couple of years between them, and it is not always plain sailing. Not always are these sibling relationships marked by close connection. Sometimes it can be a little bit angsty. Just gonna throw it out there. But actually where Christine and Deanna was concerned, that was not the case. And her mum joked that Deanna actually learned to walk at 9 months of age just so she could keep up with her elder sister. And Christine described Deanna as her shadow, which I think is a gorgeous description. I think when we ultimately consider our sibling relationships, and I'm sure that lots of us have got very close relationships with our siblings, but the idea of an elder sibling considering you their shadow, but in a really positive sense, that just shows what a close connected relationship there was. Because like I said, a lot of us have got fraught relationships with our family members, even the family members that we adored. And Deanna and Christine even shared a bedroom. And their mother recalled on one occasion that she found them making chicken soup in the toilet. I'm gonna put it out there now. It's an unusual place to create chicken soup, but I think we can all remember the days gone by where as kids, we thought lots of things were a good idea, such as the mud pies that I would make and then try to serve to the local children. Or the fact that, I don't know, you could go into the kitchen, get quite a lot of different items you knew nothing about, pop into a bowl and try to convince your siblings that it was a really good idea to just taste them in your special blind taste test competition that would involve in the end quite high levels of nausea, but never mind. At least there was creativity in my childhood. I'm sure that a lot of you relate to that. Deanna was also known to be really, really close to her mother. And I think that that's something that's going to become very, very present throughout what I talk about today. Because when we're talking about the loss of a child, for most of us, we will never experience or incur such a loss. And that's a good thing because it is beyond tragic, but it's also beyond transformative in families. And certainly this story is going to evidence exactly that. To lose somebody like Deanna, it has tragic ripples throughout relationships. Her mum actually said that one of the things that they used to love doing together was just to go shopping. And she would recall that they would just have mother and daughter chats on the sofa bed and just talk about life. And again, we're seeing this very connected, loving family. Another thing about Deanna, we always want to paint a picture of a victim, and a victim is always a victim. Everybody has shades of good and bad. So sometimes we talk about victims whose lifestyles and choices might have placed them in positions where they've come to harm, but they never deserved that harm. They never deserved anything terrible to happen to them. And I want to make that clear before I talk about the good elements of somebody like Deanna, because of course, life is life and it's precious, whoever you are. But Deanna really does exemplify that pro-social type of human being. She was just a loving member of her family, a loving member of her community. But she even used to help her gran, and her grandma had Alzheimer's. So we're seeing something really quite beautiful about this girl growing up. She's got all the traits and attributes that we want to see in young people in our society. Because when you have that kindness, consideration, compassion, when you have that absolute connection to the people of meaning, when you want to extend that to your community because you want to work with kids, we're seeing all of these great things that, in respect of who she will be in the future, suggest very good things for her community and the world at large. We get to March 1995. Now, this is when Deanna's just turned 17. She has every single thing that she could possibly wish to live for. One, she's very, very pretty. She's got these really beautiful green eyes, incredibly popular at her school. She was a great student at Somerville High School. And the people who knew her, her peers, her teachers, they described her as a fun girl with this amazing smile. And you'll be able to see from her photographs that that's a very fitting tribute to this child. She was constantly laughing. She was making others laugh too. One of the things that she apparently didn't like about herself, which I find really lovely, is that she didn't like being short. She was 5'2" and she was a size 0. So she was incredibly petite, enviably petite. A lot of us ladies will be out there thinking, I'm 5'8". When I wear heels, I look taller than a lot of men. And also, even though I'm quite a petite woman, I have quite big shoulders. A little bit like a rugby player in that respect. So the idea of being so beautifully petite, that's something that's relatively appealing to somebody like me. But I appreciate that for somebody of her stature, she may have felt differently. I also think that when we talk about the case today, also recognizing that at that height and at that size, you have less opportunity to defend yourself as somebody my height and size would. But in spite of her very petite size, I think what we could say is what she lacked in height, she absolutely made up for with her great, caring and outgoing personality. Her mum said that even though she was obviously beautiful, she really didn't know it. She wasn't somebody who understood the impact that she had on those around her. She just didn't really acknowledge how beautiful she was. And apparently, she could eat 6 slices of Leone's pizza in one sitting, which I think is pretty admirable for somebody so petite. She also is said to have absolutely adored the colour purple. She loved Pepsi. She loved sour pickles. These kind of reflections I'm putting in here because it paints a life that's lost. We can talk about Deanna just as a name. We can talk about Deanna as a girl who gets murdered. Or we can talk about Deanna as a person of meaning and the idiosyncrasies that made her her. I think the reflections and recollections of her mother are really powerful. It paints a picture of her personality, as well as just a picture that we see in these kind of films that people like me make. Another thing that was amazing about Deanna is that she had a really busy schedule. She kept really active in her life. So she took part in lots of extracurricular activities. She was involved in the child development program at her school. So she worked with third graders. And all this was great experience because she wanted a future career where she dreamt of becoming a preschool teacher. Or to be honest, from what I've read about her, she wanted to work with children per se. That was what she was more concerned about. As long as she was working with children, she would have been happy. And she was known to genuinely love and connect with kids. So she was one of those girls in the local community where she regularly babysat for other families because they trusted her. In fact, she was known to be the favourite neighbourhood babysitter, which I love. I mean, I used to babysit a lot when I was a kid. And I have always loved being around children. I have enjoyed and thoroughly connected with being a mother. But another thing that I liked when I went babysitting was because, I don't know about you guys, but the thing for me about babysitting is that when you went to other people's houses, they had food that you weren't used to. So I would go and babysit, which was great fun. And then I would just graze my way through the evening using other people's cupboards to satiate my desires for these food types. Just throwing it out there. Some of you may have just done it, like Deanna, because she liked kids. I'm just saying it was a way of expanding my repertoire of food. Also, she worked part-time at the local Star supermarket. In fact, she just finished her cashier training before she was killed. So this is a young girl who's constantly developing. She volunteered at the Somerville Cable Access Television Network. So she filled her schedule really effectively. And it says about her capacity to fit in. It says about her likability. It says that people trusted her. These are really important traits within this child. She's 17, she's not an adult yet, but wow, is she working hard on becoming the best adult she could possibly be. Now, aside from doing all that I've just talked about, which is showing very pro-social, hard-working capacity that this girl has, she was also a regular teenager. So she wasn't a complete angel, nor would we expect her to be. So she did truant occasionally. She was known to nick the odd cheeky cigarette. I think back in the day, a lot of us remember that that was just par for the course of being a teenager, wasn't it? Young people these days are into vaping, aren't they? Back in, you know, 20, 25 years ago, taking cigs from your parents if they smoked, or nicking your mate's cigs when you were out socially, was just something that was normal. And she certainly fitted that paradigm. Again, truancy, I kind of look back at my own life. I'm sure many of you look back at your life. I spent a lot of time truanting. It's also why I'm really, really good at pool. So, swings and roundabouts, swings and roundabouts. Now, in Deanna's personal life, like I've said, she's really popular. She's got a really busy social life. She's got a massive group of friends. Also, she's got a boyfriend. This is a guy called Tommy LeBlanc. Now, he's been dating her for 2 years at this point. What does that tell us again? There's a lot of consistency, there's commitment, there's stability. Holding down a relationship between the ages of 15 and 17 is not an easy feat to achieve. A lot of us think that a month lasts for 100 years. Times that by 24. That's good going. So again, just reintroducing us to this girl's ability to hold down good relationships and also to show commitment. Now, they'd apparently met through a friend of a friend, and that friend also worked at the supermarket where Deanna worked. Now, unlike Deanna, who was very outgoing, she's very gregarious, Tommy is actually considered by other people to be relatively quiet, relatively withdrawn. And a lot of people will pose the question, well, why would Deanna, who's hugely popular, very beautiful, very gregarious in that local community, why would she connect with somebody this way? But when you look at the reality of relationships, your personality traits are one aspect. And a lot of us will have friends who are quieter than us, who are solid and trustworthy, who we adore. And actually, when you look at what makes great relationships, it tends to be compatibility, values, goals, similar interests. You can have all of those without being an extrovert. You know, you can be an introvert with all of those similar connections and beliefs and meet somebody who's highly extroverted, and all of those things gel you together. But I would say her friends weren't enamored with him. And according to some of Deanna's friends, the reason for this is that they felt that he was quite controlling and they believed that he was relatively possessive of her. Bringing that into focus, it would not be unusual at 17 years of age for an individual to be more possessive of a partner than they'd be 10 years down the line. Because when you're young, you don't have a lot in your life. Therefore, when you fall in love, it can feel very big, overwhelming, and you can have a lot of fear associated with the fact that that relationship may end, and that can make you act in ways that on reflection are actually not very acceptable. But at the time, you didn't have the conscience, you didn't have the life experience, you didn't have the relational experience. And so the consequence is that you behave relatively badly compared to how you do when you're older. And I think every single human being is watching this right now. You would be in denial if you didn't look back at when you were a teenager and think, maybe that wasn't the best way to act. The obvious aim is that we move through those behaviours and we recognise they're toxic. So, like I said, I'm not giving him a get out of jail card free for this. I'm saying that it's not unusual for people to be more jealous and controlling when they're younger. The art is to move through that as people grow up because they recognise their bad behaviour traits. So we get to Wednesday. It's 29th of March, 1995. Now, this afternoon, Kathy, Deanna's mum, she happens to get the same bus as Deanna. So she's going to work and Deanna's off to see her boyfriend, Tommy. Later that day, they have a chat on the phone and Deanna tells her mum that she's going to be home after watching TV with Tommy. Her mum has the conversation and as she puts the phone down, she says before doing so, "I love you." And Deanna ended the call with the words, "I love you too, Mum." Those conversations that we have with loved ones, often we do that, don't we? We end it with, "I love you too." And I think it's really important because none of us know what's promised. We don't know whether we're going to get a tomorrow. We don't know when it's going to be the last goodbye, the last "I love you." But without a doubt, for Kathy, she couldn't have for one second imagined, not even in her worst nightmares, that those words, they'd be the last that she ever heard Deanna speak. Imagine the reality of that. She's just having an ordinary conversation with her beloved daughter, the girl that she hangs out with on the sofa bed, chatting about the future, the girl she goes shopping with, the one that she adores. And she's just having that conversation with her like so many times before. And it's the last one that she's ever going to speak. Now, earlier that day, Deanna had actually completed an assignment at school and she'd had to list these 5 objectives in life. So Deanna wrote that she wanted to graduate high school. She wanted to find a successful job, one that she liked. She wanted to have a dark green convertible Mustang. She wanted to have a happy family. But she stated that the most important goal that she had in that moment in time was to live a long and healthy life. It's a tragic, ironic twist, isn't it? That she'd literally write this on her last day alive. Such a juxtaposition to what we're talking about today. This girl just so full of life, this desire to achieve so much, from the car that she was going to drive to the job she was going to do. But the most powerful part is that she loved life enough to want to live a long, long, healthy life. Now, as she mentioned to her mother, and as she often did, Deanna went and spent the evening at Tommy's house. So she'd often go there after school, she'd do her homework, she'd study there. There was a very clear curfew that she had to accept. It was 10 p.m. and her mum said that this was genuinely something that she stuck to most of the time. I mean, we're going to allow anybody to occasionally forget to get home for their curfew. The end of the day, you're watching a good film, you forget. Somebody orders pizza, you forget. I don't know, you're having a little bit of fun with your boyfriend, you forget. It happens, but she usually was genuinely back on time. Tommy only actually lived about 0.5 mile away, and so it was about a 10-minute walk, so no big deal. This was something that had been done many, many, many times. But 10 p.m. comes, and then 10 p.m. goes, and there's no sign of Deanna. Now, Kathy is worried. She's incredibly close to her daughter. She knows this is not typical behaviour, so she stays up and waits for her. And obviously, during that period of time, she'll have felt frustrated, angry even, because the logistics of this means that she's got to be worried. Now, she is still on the couch when she falls back asleep, but she's obviously in and out of consciousness at that point because she wakes up around midnight. So there's something going on within Deanna's mother that is nervous. She's feeling annoyed. Deanna's not back when she checks to see. And at the end of the day, she's probably thinking to herself, why is she putting me through this? She's with a boyfriend, it's all going to be fine. But at the end of the day, she knows the rules. So she's feeling frustrated and she's feeling anxious. You can see that by the fact that she's waking up. Now, Gianna's birthday had been just 3 days earlier on. And one of the gifts that she'd been given from her parents was a pager. Now, if those of you out there don't know what a pager is, it's also known as a bleeper, but it's very 1990s is what I'm gonna say. You might see it in hospitals where doctors get paged, and basically it's a telecommunications device, it's wireless, and it sends you a message. And then basically you would call the message, you would find out from the person what the message was, or you'd see it come up on your screen, and it would tell you what you needed to know. I know, for those of you with mobile phones, you'll be like, why? Well, actually, I had a pager many years ago. I'm not gonna lie, I didn't find it very, very useful at all. But the point is, they were very 1990s. So Kathy, of course, tries to page Gianna because she wants to know where she is. Is she safe? And she gets no answer. Now, in that moment, you have a choice to make, don't you? Do I look at the history of what's happened with my child? She's always come home safe. She's been with a boyfriend, he's safe. She's probably asleep. Or do I think, my God, something terrible has befallen my child? There's no historical reason why Kathy thinks that something terrible has happened to Deanna. Instead, she just puts it down to the fact that she's lightly fallen asleep at her boyfriend's and she thinks, I'm gonna go to bed, it's gonna be fine. I'll see my daughter in the morning. I think a lot of parents can remember moments where their children haven't been back on time or where they haven't turned up at all. And in the pit of your stomach, you have that fear, but you also have that rationale that sure, it's going to be okay because you can't even bear to imagine that something terrible could have happened to them. And actually, most of us as teenagers will have done things that we shouldn't have done and be able to recall and reflect on times when we didn't turn up and we were okay. And that bias is going to create a belief system that says, it's going to be fine. Except for in this case, it isn't fine. So on the morning of the 30th of March, it's a Thursday, Kathy realises that Deanna hadn't returned home at all. So in this moment, she just assumes, well, maybe she's fallen asleep at her boyfriend, she's woken up, and now she has to go to school from Tommy's. So she rings Tommy's house, and she actually tells him to tell Deanna to get her butt home. You can imagine that, can't you? Because she's kind of annoyed with him as well. You know the curfew. She's meant to be home. So you better make damn sure that she gets to school this morning. But the reality of the response is not what she expects. Tom is really confused. And he says, no, Deanna isn't here. She left about 11 p.m. the night before and I walked her back home halfway. I let her walk the rest of the way by herself, but it was only a short journey. Now, for Kathy, this didn't ring true. That's how I'll say it. It didn't ring true for her. And the reason it didn't ring true for her is because he had walked her home every single time before this, all the way to her door. And that therefore seemed out of character that Tommy would only walk Deanna halfway home. Now, at this moment in time, clearly, Kathy's really concerned. She's thinking, what on earth happened to my daughter? So she speaks to her husband, Michael. And Michael does what any good parent and caregiver does. He goes out to search for her. Kathy goes into work. She's obviously still hoping for the best. And some people might think, well, why would you go into work when your 17-year-old daughter seems to have disappeared? I cannot express how many people go into autopilot. And part of it is a survival mechanism. It says, if I just carry on doing everything normally, going through the motions of my life, then everything's going to be okay. If I just hold on to the habits that I've carried out every single day, then everything's going to work out fine. Deanna's going to be okay. Michael, of course, is driving around looking for her, can't see her. So he goes to Deanna's high school. But she hasn't turned up for classes that morning. Shortly after, he received a visit from a police officer. And at that point is given the news that every parent dreads. It's the news that haunts our nightmares. It's the news that inhabits our darkest fears. And the idea that anyone could ever speak those words in reality to us is something that's even hard to imagine, to comprehend, let alone to live. The search for missing Deanna didn't last very long because on Thursday, the 30th of March, 1995. It's around 8 a.m. Two young girls were just taking a short cut to their school, just going about the business, chatting about what's going to happen that day. And all of a sudden, they make the most horrific discovery. Beneath a tree, next to a fence, just behind an old age housing complex, they find Deanna. Her body is just partially clothed. She's lying on her back, and she's literally just a block from her home, so she genuinely did nearly make it home. Even worse for these two poor girls who are traumatised in the moment that they find Deanna, they know her. She's babysat in the past for both of the girls. Can you imagine the fact that now we're not just talking about the horror of finding a body, we're talking about finding a familiar person who's been in their lives. Now, it's clear that she was sexually assaulted, and they're also able to see pretty early on that she'd been manually strangled to death. And one of her legs was actually partially out of her trousers, and she only had one sock on. And the reason that this is very telling is because it shows that it's clear that she put up a really big struggle. Now, there are some reports that suggest that she has some broken bones, but I couldn't find out what those broken bones were. It could have been a reference to the hyoid bone in the throat, because that's often broken when somebody strangles you. And some other reports did suggest that she had a broken hip. Now, if she had a broken hip, I would say that indicates a very fierce struggle. She's a young woman, healthy bones. It takes damn hard impact or struggle to break that kind of a bone. Now, the police are very quickly at the scene of the murder. This is terrifying for the local community, and they launch a murder investigation immediately. Officers notified Michael at home, of course, as I've told you, that Deanna's been killed. Can you imagine what he has to do then? The stepfather, the husband of Kathy, he has to talk to his wife. He has to let Kathy know that Deanna's dead. No, he rang her at work, and he told her that you need to come home. She asked why, and he said, you know why. Kathy at this point must have had her heart drop to her stomach, and she must have known that something truly dreadful had occurred, but I don't think even in that phone call she could have truly connected with the gravity and horror that she's about to face. She rushes home. There are police cars everywhere. And when she's actually told that Deanna was dead, her world literally fell apart. Those who saw what happened said that she became absolutely hysterical. She began to thrash about, and every single thing changed for that family that day. The Kremen family went from this lovely, connected, happy, genuinely grateful family who loved each other in such totality, and then this horror impacted on their world in every way, shape and form. And the origin of this horror spread. And it spread so drastically and so darkly that in many ways it consumed this family. Now, shortly after Deanna's death, the intersection at Jack Street and Temple Street in Deanna's neighbourhood was actually named Deanna Kremen Square in her honour. So you can see she had a real impact on that community, and they wanted to give her a sense of legacy. And I know it doesn't bring her back. And I know it doesn't mean that Deanna's family have some peace and closure because of this kind of action. But you know what it does to me? It says that Deanna Kremen haunts whoever's done it. She's in that local area permanently. And if the killer is too, then the reality is that it's inescapable for them. And I like to imagine that that message haunts them constantly, and that she catches up with them again and again and again. And so even though they're escaping justice at this moment in time, she is creeping further and further and further into their psyche, particularly as we know DNA is improving, particularly as we know that cold cases are getting solved every single day. I hope that's the case in this case. And I hope as he walks in that area, or drives in that area, he feels her presence. He feels her getting closer and closer to justice. Now, when they investigated this initially, there were three suspects that were initially identified. Now, the first and foremost was the obvious one that we would all expect, Tommy, so Deanna's boyfriend. So first of all, why would they suspect him? Well, we all know why. He was the last one to see her alive. So when you're the last person to see somebody alive, you're also the most likely to have killed them. Now, like Kathy, detectives did actually think it was really strange that Tommy, who always walked Deanna to her front door, seemingly didn't the night that she was murdered. So that's a deviation from his usual routine. So that stands out. Also, he would always call her when he got home because it was a way of letting her know that he was safe. So why not that night? So not only hadn't he walked her to her front door, he then hadn't actually called her when he'd got home to his house. Now, Tommy actually had an explanation for this. He said, yeah, you know what? I did usually walk her home and call her from my house when I got home. And I did deviate from my normal plan, but there's a reason for it. I'd ordered food before I'd set off with Deanna. I needed to be back to get my takeaway. So I didn't walk her all the way home. And he was actually, to be fair, able to produce a receipt for the order. However, I will also note the report suggests that one of the things that investigators did notice is he seemed to have some unexplained scratches on his arms and his cheek on the day following his girlfriend's murder. That is concerning. I can't testify to how those scratches on his arms and cheek arrived, but it isn't what we'd expect to see, particularly after a girl has been murdered and that person has been with that girl that day and evening. Nonetheless, detectives end up speaking to Tommy and going through this with him, and he just maintains that he's walked halfway back with Deanna. She'd been alive and well when they parted company, and that he left her at the intersection of Heath and Bond Street. Now, Deanna's body was actually found less than 500 feet from where Tommy claimed that they went their separate ways. Also, I do think his behaviour was questionable. I'm not going to lie, because I think that if you have lost your girlfriend in the most heinous of ways, even if you are coming under suspicion, it's your job and duty, if you're innocent, to help. Even if that can feel at times as if people are pointing the finger at you. If you have nothing to hide, you've nothing to hide. So you may as well help investigators as much as possible, because your main belief would be, I need to know who hurt my girlfriend. I need to bring to justice the killer of my girlfriend. And he isn't like that. He becomes really uncooperative with police during the investigation. And that doesn't bode well for him. But again, just to bring balance in, if you are a 17-year-old young man and your girlfriend has been murdered and people are starting to look at you as if you may be the person responsible for that murder, and there are these kind of foundations for that belief, such as you had scratches on your face and you didn't actually go your usual route and your behaviour changed in such a way that meant that you were separated from your girlfriend and then she suddenly turns up dead and so on and so forth, you could imagine that there would be a high level of stress. And that he may feel fearful about his freedom being taken away unfairly, and therefore he just decides in the end he's not going to cooperate anymore. Maybe he feels angry because people are looking his direction where he knows that he hasn't actually done it, and therefore he just doesn't want to continue engaging with the investigation because he's fearful that that means they aren't looking elsewhere. Just to bring balance, like I said, it's unusual behaviour. The scratches certainly worry me, but I also think we have to look at both sides in that moment, and he is very young. 2 months after Deanna's body's found, Tommy's mother actually takes a restraining order against him. She says that apparently he gets really volatile and his mood swings are really bad, and that this coincided with Deanna's death, so she couldn't handle his behaviour. Now again, arguably we can say, well, that doesn't look good for Tommy. Suddenly he's been really volatile. He's got really high level mood swings to such a degree that his mother doesn't even want him to be around her because she's scared of that behaviour. Certainly that would suggest that there is a level of violence potentially within him, and that therefore could be translated to, well, maybe it's possible that he did kill Deanna. Again, to bring balance to this, this occurs after the actual death of Deanna. So we could argue that PTSD has a potential to do the same. People get volatile, people get angry, people's mood swings if they've been exposed to a horrific trauma. And certainly if he loved his girlfriend and he feels guilty because he didn't get her home that night, and if he'd walked her to the front door, we wouldn't be telling this story. It is possible that he's highly traumatized. Now, a second suspect was a local firefighter. Deanna and her friends, they would sometimes walk past a fire station on the way home from school, and I'm just throwing it out there. Men and women in uniform, they can catch your eye a little bit, can't they? I'm not saying that the person beneath it is not important. I'm saying that a body can be embellished with a nice uniform. And apparently the girls would flirt with the firemen, totally contextual with the age frame. But there is one particular fireman who seems to really take an interest in Deanna. And some actually go so far as to say that he became obsessed with her. Now, she was half his age at the time, so there is a massive difference. And there were actually some rumours that he'd been harassing her, even stalking Deanna before her death. Now, it seems as well that this individual came from a really well-to-do family with political connections. What do I hear you ask? What does that mean, Emma? Political connections? Why should that make us look closely at this? I don't know. It's just there's a whole heap of cases that are out there in the press where things haven't been followed up as they should be because, you know, your dad's friends with the mayor or your uncle's involved with a guy running for Senate. All of that stuff. Just saying, political connections can be political corruption in certain places. Just throwing it in there. Throwing it in. It's in there. I've thrown it in. Not saying it is. Just saying, you know, political connections and all that. So there have actually been indications that Deanna may have actually had some involvement with this guy. Some people say that they saw her kissing him in a car. Again, that's only anecdotal. It doesn't actually make it real. People can see things, hear things that aren't actually factual and aren't actually real. But there are some people who say that that was happening, that she was even planning on breaking up with Tommy. But it's really difficult, I think, in a case like this to separate rumours from fact. Now, the third male who was a suspect, he's been unnamed, so to speak. We don't know who he is. But he was seen near the location where Deanna's body was found. And the description of him is that he's white, around 5'10", about 12 stone, aged 40 to 45. And it's unclear through my research if this guy was ever identified or not. What I think we can all agree is testament to Deanna's height and frame, pretty much any of these people could have been somebody that could have overpowered her and harmed her because she was so petite. Now, there was actually a fourth suspect that was identified. He would deny killing Deanna, but he'd also describe in detail to police what he would have done to her had he done it. He was, shall I say, a weirdo. But also more serious than that, because he ends up getting imprisoned in Massachusetts for an unrelated rape. Now, he was cleared of any involvement in Deanna's murder, but you can see, can't you, that there are these different individuals, personalities, characters who are potentially involved with her murder, but there's nothing that's standing out to give us any real direct connection with, yes, this person is 100% guilty of killing this girl. So ultimately, no one's charged with Deanna's murder. Now, bear in mind, when she was murdered, we're talking DNA is in its absolute infancy. And at the time, it was that there was insufficient evidence to identify the perpetrator because we are, at that point, in such infancy. Even though nowadays technology is just, wow, so cutting edge, we are literally historically, only a few decades ago, dealing with a completely different world where being able to connect the perpetrator with the victim is concerned. So the investigation goes cold. I talked a little bit earlier on about the impact of Deanna's death, and I just want to cover that for a moment before we move on because it's been absolutely devastating. They never recovered in any way, shape or form from losing their girl in such horrifically brutal circumstances. Compounded, of course, by what I've just talked about, the killer has never been found. Her stepfather, Michael, he died at just 58 years old. Losing Deanna completely destroyed him. And again, this is a stepfather. This is somebody who chose to be in that child's life, chose to be a father, and became so enmeshed and ingrained within that child's life that he lost a daughter, full stop. There's no differentiation. Michael considered Deanna a daughter and he lost a daughter, and it absolutely destroyed him. Her mother, Kathy, devoted, loving, wonderful. She started to suffer from major depression. She lost a job. She couldn't stop crying at work. I mean, that to me seems completely rational. I'm going to be honest with you. I think there should be some real clear packages that if somebody loses a child in such circumstances and they can't work, they should be financially looked after. It's brutal that somebody has to try to survive in such circumstances. Why would you be able to go to work and not cry? Every teenager that walks past you, you're thinking, that should be my daughter. Every man that walks past you, you're thinking, this could be my daughter's killer. This is happening moment after moment in Kathy's life. And she can't cope. This depression is driving her insane. And so she starts to self-medicate. She looks for anything that can dull that pain. She gets addicted to drugs. She gets addicted to alcohol. She loses her house. Her marriage ends. The one thing I would say is, in spite of the agony of this loss and the devastation and destruction that just causes such fallout in Kathy's life, somehow she manages to turn her life around, which I think is unbelievably warrior-like, because to go through what we're talking about today in survivors and mother is something I can't comprehend. And we have to mention Deanna's older sister, Christine. Because this young woman, she actually had to be mother to her younger brothers from the age of 18. It's testament to Christine, because that is a hard role to take up when you're dealing with the loss of your extraordinarily close sibling. You're managing the murder in your mind. You're dealing with the injustice of a killer being out there. You may be even fearful of your own life because they've taken your sisters. And yet you find the mental wherewithal to carry on and to look after and protect your little brothers. She actually went into denial. She tried to block it out because it was so painful for her to think about. And even though we all know it would be haunting her every single moment of every single day, I think it's good that she psychologically compartmentalized it to some degree so that she could be a good sibling mother, so to speak, to her brothers. Because otherwise I think it would have absolutely consumed her too. Now we get to 2017. Guys, this is 20 years after the murder. And suddenly there are shocking revelations in Deanna's case. So police have never let this go. Let's put that into context. Yeah, it's been difficult. Yeah, it's been cold to some degree, but it's never been let go of. Remember, Deanna's name is everywhere in that area. Kathy's never let it go either. I'll talk about that in a minute. So she is all over that area. So her memory's never faded. And now police get this new evidence. And allegedly, this evidence is horrible. Because if this is true, it absolutely speaks to the corruption that exists in places that should never have corruption at all. So it's suggested that the city's mayor's office may have been involved in an alleged stifling tactic. Yeah, they stalled and stifled the investigation. So police had apparently identified a suspect, and that suspect, it transpires, was well known to city officials, may even have been related to a high-ranking member of the city administration. Yeah. So what we're talking about there is the purposeful interference in the murder of a 17-year-old girl to protect a potential perpetrator because a member of their family or a connection had strings that could be pulled so that this case could stall. Imagine knowing that as a mother, the way that you'd feel. Now, I will also say from my research, I couldn't identify who that person was, but what I would know is that is deeply disturbing. And when I looked at the written evidence, the evidence itself had been heavily censored. So you can kind of read the little bits about what it's saying, and it's clearly identifying that this person is potentially a predator, but you can't see who it is. Which again, I don't know, speaks to a really disturbing reality, doesn't it? That we could have a perpetrator walking around who the authorities are aware of, and they've got the protection of these individuals because they are corrupt in places where they're meant to be protecting us. Then we get to 2019. The Cold Case Unit re-examines the case. Now, this, of course, is with the benefit of the latest DNA testing and profiling. Now, according to rumours, and again, this is only stuff that I can tell you regarding what I'm picking up from the case itself and the conversations around that, the rumours are that investigators believe they know exactly who killed Deanna, but they need more evidence before they can prosecute them. Now that excites me. It excites me in lots of ways, but mostly it excites me because I believe she haunts this human, and I believe he knows she's coming for him. I'm sure that a lot of you who hear me talk like this also mirror those feelings. The idea that the investigators know who've done it, they're just waiting. That person is an imprisoned man walking. They just don't know it yet. And maybe they do know it. Maybe they know they're living on borrowed time. And maybe they're realizing that whatever protection they think that they have is wearing thin. Now, Deanna's family, they still hold a special remembrance event every March. It's around the time of her birthday. And each year they erect a billboard offering a reward for information about her killer. And there's a quote on the billboard and it reads, "You know what you did to me. How much longer must I wait? Please help make my time in heaven restful." And I think that's very powerful. And the fact that she's speaking to the killer, she's speaking directly to them. It's very profound. It's not the parents saying, "Please let us know what happened to our daughter." It's not a sibling saying it. It's Deanna. "You know what you did to me. You know what you did to me." They really want to keep the public aware of this unsolved murder. They don't want people to forget. And they genuinely believe that one day that perpetrator is going to be caught. Or maybe that this perpetrator is going to realise that finally they have a shred of conscience. And I don't know, if they don't want to find the lift down at the end of their days, maybe they'll hand themselves into authorities. You know? Maybe there is an opportunity for an individual to truly overcome their sin. Maybe they just need to have the good conscience and the reality of a growing morality to just go and say it was me. In the hope that there'll be forgiveness, maybe not in this life, maybe in the next. But then if they don't and they get caught, I would imagine it's a one-way ticket to a very hot place. And I'm not talking about a nice two-week break all-inclusive to Jamaica, throwing it out there. I'm talking about eternal hell, being burnt a lot at the pleasure of the devil. Now, there's a $70,000 reward. It's a big reward, guys. All they want is information that's going to lead to Deanna's killer's apprehension. That's life-changing. If somebody knows anything out there, that's $70,000. It's life-changing, genuinely. Not just for the family, because they'll know who has killed Deanna, but also for the individual brave enough to have the courage to actually go and talk to the authorities. And it's one of those, so often people don't really think that they've got the missing information required. They think that, oh, it was just something I saw, just something I heard. But if you actually go and have a conversation with law enforcement, you find that the jigsaw puzzle was missing that piece, your piece, and suddenly you're $70,000 richer and the family have the closure they so dearly deserve. Deanna's case actually remains one of 13 unsolved murders in Somerville since 1980. It's quite a lot, isn't it? 13 since 1980. And like I said, the one thing that is very clear about Deanna is she's gone nowhere from people's memories. They keep her alive. They're all fighting for her justice. Her friends and family, they're never quiet about this. Now, during the years since Deanna's murder, her family have been told numerous times that there are these promising developments in the case, But even though they're meant to be so promising, nothing really ever comes to fruition. The hopes are always being dashed. No arrests ever being made. Her mother, Kathy, actually stated this. She was just a good person. She would have become a better person. Because of the person Deanna was, no one's going to give up on getting justice for her. That's powerful, isn't it? No one's giving up. She's basically saying, I will spend my life, we will all spend our lives fighting for Deanna's justice. So you better be ready for us. You better know that we are coming for you. We're never giving up. It's absolutely tragic to me that Deanna's family have never had any form of closure, and the fact that every single happy occasion will always be marred by loss. It's the same for my own tragic loss of my dad. When you've gone through traumatic grief, every single happy event feels tinged with this sadness because they're not there to experience it. For Deanna's family, they're meant to have had her children. She's meant to have had a career. They're meant to be a close, happy unit, and it's been denied them. And the only thing that can heal a little bit of the wound, it can't fully heal by any stretch of the imagination, but heal a little bit of the wound, is to know that the bastard responsible for her brutal death is literally banged up for the rest of their life. That's the only way that there can begin to be some healing around that. Bear in mind the fact that they've been so brave to keep Deanna in the public eye, but it also means they've had to constantly grieve in public just to keep the case open in the public eye. They dread every year when March comes around, the anniversary of her death. You know, her mother falls apart every single year. Deanna has now been dead 10 years longer than she was alive. Can you believe that? 10 years longer than she was alive. I will tell you what the family think, and this is not me putting my own spin on what I believe. I just want to express their beliefs. So they believe that Deanna's boyfriend, Tommy LeBlanc, was responsible for her death. They feel that he was the last one to see her alive, and he didn't walk her to her house that night. He didn't call her after like he usually did. There are two things that he always did. So they feel that either way, he's responsible. As far as they're concerned, they conclude that, okay, evidently, there's a lack of physical evidence that ties Tommy to the actual crime. So therefore, as far as they're concerned, it might not be that he actually physically murdered Deanna, but he didn't actually get her home. And therefore, as far as the family is concerned, if he had walked her to a front door like he'd always been trusted to do before, we wouldn't be telling this story. So either way, whether he actually murdered her or whether he allowed her in their mind to be murdered, it's his fault. But I also need to know that if you are Tommy and you are completely innocent, it must be really tough for him. He must be constantly under that shadow of suspicion. And of course, he would have absolutely had to live with the guilt of knowing that she'd still be alive if he walked her home like he normally did. So if he's innocent, then I actually understand why he avoids the interviews with the press, because he's been presumed guilty without a trial. Again, for the due process of balance, his guilt could also be a reason to avoid interviews. And I will note, he still remains today a person of interest in the investigation. But no matter what happens there, as far as Kathy is concerned, it all draws back to him. He either failed to get her daughter home safely, or he's the reason she didn't get home safely. Like I said, just for the reason of balance, I think it would be very difficult if he's innocent for a 17-year-old boy to manage emotionally the loss and also the suspicion of a whole community. Now, in March 2017, this is the 22nd anniversary of Deanna's death. Her mother actually reached out to Tommy in a public letter begging him to speak to the police and to assist investigators. She said, "Today, on the 22nd anniversary of my daughter Deanna's death, I'm still haunted by questions. For that reason, I'm begging you to please reach out to the state police and be kind enough to be re-interviewed. I'm well aware of how painful it is for you to go back down this road, but I'm pleading with you to help me, to help Deanna. You were the last one to spend time with her that night. no one can help her case like you can. Please tell me. Please help. Now, she didn't receive a response. But again, I've highlighted why that may be, aside from potential guilt. Now, you would imagine that this family have had enough tragedy to last them a lifetime, but I'm afraid I can't leave it there, because more tragedy hit the Kremen family in 2017. On the 8th of March that year, the amazing Christine, Deanna's sister, she died suddenly aged 40. She had a young son that she left behind. It's really sad, isn't it? One, that little boy won't really know his mother as he deserved to, this incredible girl who sacrificed so much to be there for her younger siblings, and yet she can't be there for her own child. And I can take some comfort that she's with her sister, but it's the fact that she was never given the justice of finding that killer for her sister before she took her last breath. And we cannot imagine how distressing it is for Kathy and the family. The idea that you lose a child so young at the beginning of her parenting life is just too difficult to imagine. The only thing that I can hope for right now, for the rest of the family, for the surviving members of that family's sake, is that those new developments in DNA, the profiling is finally so cutting edge that, let me tell you, if you are a perpetrator, it's a matter of time. It's a matter of time. They're coming for you. But hopefully it's going to provide them with the answers to all those questions that they've waited for so long. Also, I hope that Deanna's legacy can one day shift from one of tragedy and one of awful sadness to one of happiness and joy. I really hope that even though right now justice hasn't been served, and I feel that we need to have that justice served for the closure to some degree of that chapter in her family's life, I also hope that if that happens, and when that happens, and hey, I hope that even if it doesn't happen, still the emphasis moves from the brutality of her murder to the beauty of her life. Because the thing about Deanna was that she was a ray of sunshine. She lit up rooms, she lit up lives. She was a popular, beautiful, incredible human being who lived life fully. A life fully lived. It wasn't long enough, but it was a life fully lived. And I often think that until we give legacy to the meaning of that, as opposed to the end, we forget the importance and fullness of what was truly embraced. Deanna embraced her life. And we should always shine a light on that reality. We cannot change what happened, but we can change the power that we give the end, and we can project the power onto the life that was. And until they meet again, I hope they find the strength to do that. It's always frustrating to do an unsolved. I feel very connected to Deanna. I want the murderer to be given the justice they deserve. I hope that if anybody knows anything about this, if it jogs somebody's memory, just remember there's a $70,000 reward, and there's an opportunity to bring closure and justice to the lives of a family who so deserve it.
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.